Sandra Day O'Connor, the history-making justice who was the first woman to serve on the U.S. Supreme Court, died this morning in Phoenix from complications of dementia and a respiratory illness. Chief Justice John Roberts said today that when O'Connor joined the court in 1981, she met the challenge, quote, with undaunted determination, indisputable ability, and engaging candor. Judy Woodruff has this remembrance.
I wanted, since I was the first, not to be the last. And I wanted to do the job well so it would provide encouragement for women to serve in the future.
Sandra Day O'Connor broke the gender barrier at the U.S. Supreme Court and ultimately became a critical vote on abortion rights, affirmative action, and even the election of a president. It was a long journey from the family cattle ranch in southeastern Arizona. She recalled those early years in a NewsHour interview in 2002.
It gives a person a little confidence, a little bit of self-reliance, because you know you have to solve the problems yourself. You can't always turn to other people to do them. A belief in independence.
The young Sandra Day earned degrees at Stanford University and its law school, where she was a classmate of future Chief Justice William Rehnquist. She married another law grad, John O'Connor, and tried for a job practicing law. But it was the 1950s, and more than 40 firms turned her down. Eventually, after having children, she turned to politics, serving in the state Senate, and became a judge for Arizona's State Court of Appeals. Then, in 1981, President Ronald Reagan nominated O'Connor to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God.
I do so swear.
She described herself as a judicial conservative and won unanimous Senate confirmation. But after joining the court, she came to be regarded as more moderate and a swing vote.
Some of the decisions are made by drawing very fine lines, and reasonable people can disagree on where those lines should be drawn. I've been there, and I know how challenging it is. It is not surprising at all that some cases are decided by drawing fine lines with five people here and four people on the other side.
In 1992, Justice O'Connor was the critical fifth vote against overturning the landmark Roe v. Wade decision that legalized abortion. Later, she joined a one-vote majority in striking down state limits on so-called partial birth abortions. In 2003, she wrote the majority opinion upholding the use of race in deciding college admissions. And she voted with a 5-4 majority in Bush v. Gore, the case that ultimately settled the bitterly disputed 2000 presidential election. In later years, O'Connor acknowledged criticism that she lacked a clear judicial philosophy, but she defended her case-by-case approach.
You have to answer the question, like it or not, and the questions deserve a valid legal response. Even if the response isn't one that will be easily understood, you have an obligation as a member of the court to do what you are bound to do under federal law, even if it isn't an attractive resolution from a public standpoint.
She was the lone woman on the high court for 12 years until President Bill Clinton nominated Ruth Bader Ginsburg in 1993. O'Connor retired from the court in 2006, citing her husband's health, but continued hearing cases in the U.S. Courts of Appeals. And she made time to visit schools, actively promoting the importance of civics education.
I wanted to teach young people in America how they can be part of the governmental structure and help decide what problems to tackle and how to solve them.
The retired justice devoted much of her attention to caring for her husband, John, who suffered from Alzheimer's and who died in 2009. That same year, O'Connor was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian honor. At the ceremony, President Obama said she forged a new trail and built a bridge behind her for all young women to follow. O'Connor reflected on it all in an interview with the NewsHour in 2009.
I was asked in my Senate confirmation hearing about how I'd like to be remembered. I called it the tombstone question. And I said, I hope the tombstone might read, "Here lies a good judge."
At the age of 88, the retired justice announced she had formally withdrawn from public life. She wrote to the High Court that she had beginning stages of dementia, probably Alzheimer's. Sandra Day O'Connor lived out her final years in Arizona.
Sandra Day O'Connor was 93 years old. John Yang picks up our coverage of her legacy both on and off the Supreme Court.
O'Connor's tenure on the Supreme Court is notable not just because she was the first woman, but also because of what she did in her 24 years there. Joan Biskupic is the Supreme Court analyst for CNN and author of Sandra Day O'Connor, How the First Woman on the Supreme Court Became Its Most Influential Justice. Joan, along those lines, you write in the book that her appointment didn't just change the court, it transformed the court. What do you mean by that?
It really did, John, and it's great to be with you, even though at this moment we really feel, you know, some sadness along with the weight of history for how influential Sandra Day O'Connor was. You know, I like to say that, you know, she made history certainly by being the first woman justice on the Supreme Court, but also she was a real politician on the court. She came knowing how to count votes, knowing how to work consensus, and she had a very pragmatic style that that involved not just trying to find the center of the law in America, but also trying to find the center of the court. So, you know, there was no one like her before 1981, and there'll be no one like her, you know, going forward. She influenced so many important areas that you all just touched on, you know, abortion rights, religion, racial affirmative action. But her overall approach was to ensure that when those nine justices got together in the conference room with nobody else but them, that everyone walked away feeling like they got something. Now, people were critical of that sort of consensus-building center of the court approach she had, but it really did steady the law in America in a way that we don't have right now.
You mentioned her political skills. She was Senate Majority Leader in the Arizona Senate, and also her stand on abortion. Now, when she voted to preserve Roe versus Wade last time it was challenged, it wasn't just her vote that was important. Is that right?
That's right. She brought together a coalition. It was her and fellow Justices David Souter and Anthony Kennedy, both of whom were Republican appointees also, and, you know, got everyone together to preserve the 1973 landmark Roe versus Wade, which, of course, was overturned in last year's decision by this Supreme Court. And you referred to the 1992 decision in Planned Parenthood versus Casey. She wrote something very compelling at the time. She acknowledged that many people might not have wanted what the court did in Roe v. Wade in 1973, and she might not even have wanted it in 1973, but she wrote about how all of America had come to live with it, and she said it wasn't the court's role to impose its own morality or sense of, you know, social norms on the country, not to impose somebody's personal morality on the country, but to sort of take account of the entire population and how much that precedent had been around for at that time, you know, from 1973 to 1992, 20 years, and then it wasn't until 2022 that the court completely overturned it, obliterating nearly a half century of precedent.
And another area where she was influential was supporting or upholding race-based college admissions, which also was overturned last year. What did she say about when her opinions were overturned after she left the court? And she was asked about how she felt seeing some of her opinions overturned.
Well, you know, John, I talked to her in about 2009 at a legal conference. And at that point, not everything had been reversed. You know, the court with her successor, Samuel Alito, had already started rolling back some of her decisions, but not the big ticket ones we've just referred to. And she used the word dismantling, and she expressed frustration that her decisions were being dismantled. But little did she know what was to come.
On a personal note, Joan, you write that she was very eager for the justices to build relationships away from the court, outside the courtroom, outside the conference room. What sorts of things did she do?
Oh, you know, she was always arranging things. If it wasn't a bridge party, it was a trip to see some musical event. If it wasn't that, it's funny. She was an only child for about 12 years of her life. She had two younger siblings, but she was the kind of person who I think her instinct after her somewhat lonely life on the ranch, you know, her Lazy Bee Ranch in Arizona, made her always want to have people around. But she was, you know, I refer to her politician's touch in trying to bring people around her. And because I think she realized, John, that to have smooth relations inside the court, you needed to build relationships outside the court with your colleagues. So she was always doing dinners. She was known for, you know, trying to arrange potlucks, bringing things in for her law clerks, and also trying to enlist her fellow justices for various events. And she was the one, John, who started the practice that they have now of having lunch together on days that they hold oral arguments. And I remember Justice Clarence Thomas saying to me that she would, you know, she would say, you have to come eat with us. You have to. And she was doing that with all of them. David Souter, one of her shyer colleagues, you know, resisted a bit, but she ensured that all nine of them would have lunch together after oral arguments. And, you know, I think that built a lot of really goodwill among the justices during her tenure.
Supreme Court analyst Joan Biskupic on Sandra Day O'Connor. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John.